Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife. Today, David Drake, our guest. David is a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. He's Associate Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, a colleague of Scott Craven's. Great to have him with us again. And certainly we're looking forward to what you have to say about what's going on in your part of the world relating to wildlife. What kinds of wildlife are you seeing these days? Anything a little different? Certainly the weather has been weird.
To say the least.
To say the least. And that might, and I know it's resulted in some sort of unusual things. As we visit with David, give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page. I had a cool picture, actually, on the Facebook page. If I can ever find it. Let's see. What did I do? Oh, there it is. Got some deer.
Oh, yeah. No, somebody's trail cam, it looks like.
Trail cam by our camper near Castle Rock Lake. I forgot to change the date and didn't change the battery, so the date's wrong, but it's a cool picture anyway. Somebody had made the comment that they wondered if there was a deer in Wisconsin that hadn't had a picture taken. It's picture taken with all the trail cams that we've got running around out there, David.
It sure is. I'll tell you, those trail cams are awfully handy, though, not only for hunters, but also for naturalists and people like that. And especially now we're getting a lot of sightings, obviously, of cougars are constant. And it's nice to get some verification on the trail cam.
And even sometimes, people will call and say, I got something and is in my backyard doing this or that, and I don't know what it is. Put a trail cam up.
That's exactly right.
And do it right in your backyard.
And the Wisconsin DNR, thinks so highly of it that they've actually added a trail cam page to their website. So you can actually submit your trail cam pictures, and there's some pretty interesting and high-quality pictures out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been an incredibly warm winter in Wisconsin. We're on a pace to be the warmest on record, I believe. What are you hearing about how the wildlife are reacting?
I'll tell you, Larry, I was riding my bike in this morning. The wildlife sounded awfully happy about these mild temperatures as the birds were singing and things were out and about. So we post a phenology list in our department, usually sometime mid to end of January, something like that. And we've got postings up there already that bluebirds are back. Robins are back and singing already. And I've had a few calls already that, a couple weeks ago when we had those really mild weather or mild temperatures during the week, that a couple people are starting to see bats in their house. So bats are starting to get aroused again with these warmer temperatures and things like that. So there are certainly some unusual things going on right now and certainly seems to be attributable to that mild temperature and mild weather we're enjoying right now.
And we had Michelle sent a note to my Facebook page and said something about this. She said, we put out lots of feeders around our yard for the first time this winter. We were expecting to see a lot of birds. We're not seeing any birds.
Well, Michelle, that's a very good observation. Sometimes it just takes the animals a little bit of time to find it. And it's as if you were to move into a new state and you're not always sure where the closest McDonald's is. It takes you a little bit of time to find it. But also right now, the birds are not pressed to find food at your feeder because we don't have much snow cover down, especially in the southern part of the state, and there's plenty of natural abundance of food right now. And even when we have snow cover, unless we have really heavy, sustained cold and sustained snow cover, despite what a lot of us like to think, birds really don't need our help, even during those typical winters. And sometimes, for example, if you've got a disease that's spreading through, for example, your house finches, you've got kind of an eye infection. Sometimes attracting birds to your feeder can be a detriment to that population. So it is overall good. We all like to see birds. It's a great outreach tool for educating people about natural resources and wildlife. And because of that, bird feeding is a wonderful thing. But they don't always need our help as much as we think they do.
And I posted back to her as well that, if you don't have a tree or some bush or some cover near those feeders, they're less likely to use them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, you want to certainly put your feeders relatively close to the cover so they can hop off there if a predator comes through, be it a house cat or a sharp-shinned hawk, that they can get off that feeder and back to safety in the cover quickly.
Mike in Rice Lake has a comment or question. Hi there, Mike.
Good morning, gentlemen. I don't know if your guest is knowledgeable about birds, but A couple of weeks ago, I saw a strange bird above my feeder, white and gray, kind of about the size of a robin. And while I was frantically digging through my bird books and not finding it, there was about 4 inches of light snow on the ground, and it seemed to be just surveying the area. And then it swooped to the ground, and I thought it was like after some seeds below the feeder, but it came up with either a shrew or a mouse, flew away with it. And then I soon found out that it was a northern shrike, and they will impale their meal for later eating, I guess. But a little while later, it did the same thing. So I'm wondering, can these things actually, like an owl, figure out where that prey is under the snow by hearing it or something? Or was he possibly seeing it or what? I'd never seen this kind of behavior in a bird like this, and it was pretty fascinating to watch.
Oh, absolutely. Pretty cool. What do you think, David?
Well, Mike, I'm relatively fairly confident about my birds, but they would not let me out of graduate school until I vowed to make up stuff with authority. So I'll also make up something if I need to. But it certainly sounds like a northern shrike, and we've got two shrike species that occupy Wisconsin, the northern shrike and the loggerhead shrike. And northern shrikes are here in the winter, and loggerheads will come into our area in the summer. Typically northern shrikes, if you want to identify it, they've got a thinner, black mask on their face, and they're almost an all gray bird with that black mask across their face. And then if you look at them, especially if you get a very close up look with your eye or use a pair of binoculars, the northern shrike has both shrikes, but especially the northern shrike has a very pronounced hook on its top bill. And, they will feed off an insects when the insects are available, you know, feed on the wing. They certainly will pick up shrews and small mice and things like that. And you're absolutely right that they will impale the food on barbed wire or on thorns of bushes and trees and come back and feed on that food that they've impaled. You know, as to hearing the food or the food source, birds don't have really, really good hearing. I mean, there's some exceptions to that. Certainly owls and some of the nocturnal species do. But most likely what's happening, and I don't know if you've ever watched either voles or shrews, as they'll routinely, especially under bird feeders, pop their head up through the snow. And they'll do that just to see what's going on, but also to grab a seed that's on top of the snow. And the shrike is probably just timing his approach so that as that animal comes up, it's unfortunate for the mammal, but it's good for the shrike. But it certainly sounds like that's what you have, Mike, and they are wonderful birds to see and actually relatively common.
Great to watch. Thank you, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. Bob in Stevens Point, we turn to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Some months ago, a friend of mine's cat went missing. The neighborhood said they knew what the culprit was. Now, this past deer season, after someone who hunts on my land shot the deer, he kept his camera out there and taking pictures of deer. I said, why don't you put the camera over the gut pile and see what you get? Well, two raccoons, a fox, a coyote, and here's the animal that I've never seen live. Bushy tail like a red fox, but only it's dark on the picture. It looks black, but somebody told me it's brown. Kind of a mottled body, darker feet, but you can see the feet not as high as the coyote or the fox. And the face kind of mottled, too. And somebody else says he had seen it. It's a fisher. Are the fishers on an upswing in population and in where their territory is?
Bob, that's a good question. I am not sure about what the fisher numbers are in terms of the Wisconsin's population, but they certainly seem to be doing well. You know, they are holding their own up in northern parts of the state, and they certainly seem to be making some regular forays down to the southern part of the state. So I'm assuming that the fisher numbers are pretty good in the state of Wisconsin. And a fisher is probably you could describe it as a miniature wolverine almost.
Yeah.
In that it's a short, stocky animal. A fisher is almost all black, and especially you will not mistake a fisher because it's got a very, very bushy black tail, and that's the one defining characteristic of it. And typically, fishers, you know, are associated with older growth timber type areas. So it's possible it's a fisher. You know, there are variations in pelages or coats of animals, and it's possible that you saw a fisher that's got a bit of a mottled coat. It's also possible that you may have seen some kind of a fox, or perhaps a red fox that's got a variation in mottled coat. And there are, amongst foxes, especially red foxes, there's quite a bit of variation in their coat color. So it could have been both of those, possibly. But nonetheless, it sounds like a pretty interesting picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had the chance to observe fishers in the woods a couple of occasions. Once over a gut pile.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to watch them move around. They certainly move a lot different than a fox would move.
Yeah, they sure do. And they're much shorter closer to the ground. They've got shorter legs than a fox would, and they're not quite, you know, they're not as big in terms of body size.
And we have just had posted, thanks a lot, Bob, for calling, by the way. We have posted a white hawk that lives across the street from, let's see, what's her name, Holly. Any ideas on that one?
All right, Larry, I'm going to step away from the mic for a second. Even though I'm only mid-40s, my eyes are failing me. So just give me 1 second. I'll be right
back. And while you do that, actually, I'm going to remind everybody, you can join in. We have an open line and can get you on at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or again, go to my Facebook page, at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or comment. Or a photo there, like this white hawk that we've got.
That is a great picture. And I, you know, on first glimpse, especially with the eruption of snowy owls coming into our area, I would have suggested a snowy owl.
But although, it's not that.
No, it doesn't. It's got more, you know, you can see the shoulders that it would have like a hawk. It's a white version of some kind of a hawk. And unfortunately, it's hard to see scale on that. According to looking at the tail, I'm going to maybe say it's a white version of a Cooper's hawk, possibly, but I will certainly welcome caller input on this. And if anybody else wants to weigh in, please do.
Yeah, that'd be really cool if we get some other people in. Cooper's hawk, you think?
Well, that's what I'm going to go with right now. But
it'd be nice to know how big it was.
It would be. It really neat. And you know, obviously, that as you can see from the picture, if anybody's looking at the Facebook, you can see that animal really stands out. And because of that. That animals that have a white pelage like this and are not meant to have a white pelage or white coat, that they don't last long in nature because their predators can see them pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So if anybody else wants to take a guess, David's saying Cooper's hawk?
I'm going to suggest that, but I'm open for other suggestions as well.
All right. Let's turn to Dave in Augusta next. Dave, hi to you.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
Good morning, Larry. I want to pass along. I seen a black bear last Sunday evening. It's about 5:15. I almost hit it. It came from the north side of the road, out in the country, outside of Augusta. And I usually don't see a bear until maybe, late March, early April. And I know the weather, like you were saying, that the weather's been really nice, and it has. Is this a little early? Still, do you think?
It certainly seems a little bit early, but you know, we've also had a very unusually warm winter. So, you know, most of the animals that are hibernating, the primary trigger that gets them woken up is day length, the amount of daylight, and that usually doesn't occur until later into late winter, early spring, as you suggested, in March, April. And then there's other cues that are associated with that. Increasing day length, certainly changing weather patterns that bring precipitation, former rain, the soils start to thaw out and warm up and things like that. Yeah. But, certainly bears will arouse periodically as they hibernate, and it is very possible that right now that animal just felt enough warmth and woke up and decided to go out and see what's going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty
Maybe
cool.
It was my chocolate chip cookies that my wife made. She had the window open. Maybe that was what happened. Huh?
could be, Dave. So you should go online if you haven't already, and others too, to www.bear.org, bear.org. That's a trail cam or a bear cam. It's of a denned up bear with having cubs.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that's at bear.org. And Judith reminded me.
Okay. Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Even Economowoc. It's going to be your turn in just a minute after I remind everybody our guest today is David Drake. David is UW Extension and Associate Professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network, talking wildlife today with David Drake of the UW. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or a comment. And tell you what, let's go to Eve in Oconomowoc. Hi, Eve.
Hi, David and Larry. I'm just calling. Recently, we had a owl that took over our squirrel house. And just out of the clear blue, maybe 3 weeks ago, he just disappeared. And now I don't see him at all anymore. And I'm just wondering, we know he's in the area because we find his little droppings. But I'm wondering, since they're one of the first ones to actually, produce babies, is that possible that they might have went to a different home? Or
is that a great horned owl? Was it, ma'am, or did you?
We really can't tell.
Okay.
We finally got, a high-powered, a telescope, and that's when he moved away.
Hmm. I guess there's no coincidence there.
Probably not.
So did you hear the owl by any chance?
I did not, but he did, and he described the sound that he made, and we were kind of thinking that it was a screech owl.
Okay. Yeah, so owls are certainly great horned owls, and some of the other owl species are some of the first bird species to produce young in Wisconsin. And part of that is because some of them will certainly a cavity nest or nest in cavities. So they've got quite a bit of shelter and warmth within that cavity, and that gives them a head start on producing young over some of the other ones and over some of the other species that are out there. And in terms of the squirrel house, is it a squirrel house that's made out of an old rubber tire?
Yes.
Yeah, so...
it's a brand new squirrel house. We've had it about a year.
Okay, yep. So, screech owls are very common in Wisconsin, and they're one of the smallest owls. They're actually the second smallest owl we've got in the state of Wisconsin. And a screech owl, they're called screech owls because one of their calls is just this kind of hair-raising screech or yell that they'll make, but they also sound like a whinnying horse, if you know what that sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is very possible that they were just checking out some nesting sites. They're certainly established in setting up territory and defending territory right now. It's possible that it may also be a young owl or a non-breeder that's trying to get into the breeding population and is starting to look for a place to set up shop and attract a mate.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And, maybe the squirrel chased them. It is a squirrel house after all.
It is. But I'll tell you what, squirrels are good owl food. So I'm not sure who's going to. If I was a squirrel, I'd be careful about that.
All right. Well, let's see. We have Mary in Madison next. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yes. I was wondering, I just read last night that greenhorn owls nest in the latter part of January, and I've heard all around 3 in the morning about twice this winter an owl. It seems like a great horned. And when do they start to mate, and do they vocalize more during that time?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mary. They certainly will vocalize more as they're attracting breeders and are looking for mates and starting to defend their territory. But, November, December, they'll start to set up a territory and start looking for mates. So certainly by January, end of January or so, they could be producing young in those nests. And a great horned owl is very, very common around here. Mary, I see you're in Madison, so they're very common around Madison. They're one of the largest owls we've got that are resident owls, their sound sounds like what you'd expect a hoot owl.
It's a
hoot, 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 hoot type call. So it's not uncommon to hear them, especially November, December, and even now. So we will occasionally, when we're in bed sometimes, we'll hear, we've heard barred owls, screech owls, and great horned owls, and we're out in West Middleton. So it's pretty nice to hear them.
Yeah, thank absolutely. You. Thanks a lot for calling. We had an email from Tom Erdman, who is curator of the Richter Museum of Natural History at UW Green Bay, and he went online to the Facebook page to take a look at the hawk, and he probably has a better quality screen than we've got here, because he's saying he thinks it's a buteo, adult?
A buteo is a group of hawks, a red-tailed hawk, red-shouldered hawks, rough-legged hawks are all buteos.
Buteos,
and
okay.
Buteos are just a general classification of hawk. It's usually a larger-bodied hawk that occupies more open territory. accipiters would be something like a Cooper's hawk, sharp-shinned hawk, you know, something like that.
He thinks it's a red tail. Note the chocolate eye color, so making it an adult. So, I mean, we couldn't see the chocolate eye color on our screen.
Yeah, it's hard to see. It's, I was suggesting Cooper's simply because I saw the curved tail. But, you know, I think this is certainly open open for discussion, and I'm not sure that we're going to find the right answer, but it certainly is fun to guess about it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Facebook question from Sue in Madison. When should I put out my Oriole feeder?
Ah, yeah, you know you know what? All bets are off this year, Sue, so you may want to put it out today. Who knows? But I certainly would watch, you know, keep an eye on your backyard for orioles. And certainly there's a number of websites that track bird sightings, not only in your area, but around the state. So you could kind of check that out and see as you see the orioles start moving north. But typically, you know, birds like orioles who are both insect eaters but also fruit eaters, that they're not going to be up here until their food source is available.
Yeah,
and typically that's not right now. So,
May.
Yeah, you've got a couple of months to get the jelly ready and put the feed out.
Actually, yeah, at our place, at our lake home, they come, it's like May 5th. I think there's
yeah.
It's like almost that bear's
clockwork.
There. It's just like clockwork.
That's right.
Okay, we have Vicki and Augusta up next. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I saw an animal this fall crossing Highway 27 just south of Lake Eau Claire, which is north of Augusta on 27, about 5 miles. And the best I can explain about this animal was it was twice as long as a feline, as an alley cat, larger than an alley cat, twice as long in body with a very long black tail. It was black in color. Some people said I saw a fisher, but a fisher's tail is very bushy, and this is a very short-haired animal. As close as I can come is a juvenile black panther. I know we have had a cougars sighted in Wisconsin. Have we ever had a black one sighted?
I am not familiar with a black panther sighting in Wisconsin. Doesn't mean that they haven't occurred or are not here necessarily, but and depending on what part of the country you're in, we call them cougars here. They're called mountain lions out west, and they're called panthers down in the southeastern part of the United States. The likelihood, however, of it being a black panther, I think, is pretty impossible. So I would probably suggest instead. It is a fisher, and I understand what you're saying about the short hair and things like that. But fishers, I think, would be if I had to put a bet on something, I would bet on a fisher versus a juvenile black panther.
Yeah, and had I not seen fishers before, and known that this one is totally different, I mean, it had very very short hair,
and it had a very long tail.
A very long tail, very sleek.
Well,
body was shaped like a cat.
Yeah,
might have been a juvenile cougar.
It could have been, you know, but typically with cougars, I mean, it's really hard to mistake that cougar simply because it's just got that really thick rope-like tail that's very long, and it's, cougars are a pretty sizable animal as well, so.
Right, that's why I felt it was a juvenile animal rather than full-grown.
Yep. Yeah, it may be, but I think fisher may be a more probable sighting, and especially fishers, you know, have been known to move south, especially kind of through that Mississippi River Valley area.
Yeah, so there you go. Still up in the air. We don't know, but it's too bad you don't have a picture. Someone called, was talking to me this morning and said, you know, it'd be great if you had a camera that you could install on your hoodie or car, so you could just snap a picture when some of these things come across. Melissa in Ocano, it's your turn. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. This is actually a perfect and weird show. Thank you for it. No, this is why it's weird, because I haven't seen any early birds at all, and we have some generic bird feeders, and the first ones to come in are the tree swallows, and I usually empty out the bird feeders, or the bird houses, I'm sorry. The bird houses about mid-March, and then the birds show up, you know, a month after that. Just now, up on a telephone line, I saw a tree swallow. So you may want to put those Oriole feeders on.
Oh, man. Yeah, tree swallows already.
Yes. That's like 2 months early, so.
And Dave in Franklin was walking his dog, heard an alarm chirp, and looked up in a cottonwood tree, and there was a robin.
Yeah. Yep, we've had robins sighted already. And Melissa, not to doubt your identification of the tree swallow, but obviously the tree swallow has got a relatively long tail. It's a mostly small bird, white chest and belly, and then kind of almost like a metallic blue head down the back. And I'm guessing that's what you saw.
Exactly. Yep. We get them every year. We get to watch the babies grow up and everything.
Yep.
So much fun.
Well, as I mentioned when we first started the show, we've had a posting to our phenology list in our department of bluebirds, and certainly bluebirds and tree swallows share the same type of box. And if bluebirds are here and can survive, it's probably not terribly out of the ordinary for a tree swallow to be here. But mostly, you know, those animals that are migratory birds like that are insectivores, and they obviously leave our area because the insects are not available in the winter. So this warmer weather, though, is bringing some insects out, and you never know.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Melissa. I went back to the Facebook page looking there again, and here's a series of shots that Rick sent us. It looks like a young eagle that treed a group of wild turkeys, he says. Can eagles go after turkeys? And I would say, yeah, eagles can go after turkeys.
Yeah, eagles will harass just about anything. You know, so it'd be hard pressed for an eagle to, I think, kill a turkey. They probably could do it, but you know, turkeys are a pretty big bird as well. Even though an eagle is a big bird as well, and certainly turkeys are taking refuge in the tree for safety, and they you know, obviously they roost in trees at night as well. The picture I'm having a little bit of difficulty making out that is an eagle for sure. It certainly looks like it is. Yep, that looks like an immature eagle right there, immature bald eagle with the wings splayed out the way they are, and there's some white and black modeling on the chest and breast. And immature eagles also have white armpits, underarm armpits, and it certainly looks like that in this bird as well. So that certainly does look like an immature bald eagle.
Sure does. So thanks for sending those. Take a look at them. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Lots of good photos turning up here. Larry and Mercer, you are next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, David. A couple of comments. I come out of my shop one day, and I have a little black dog, and I caught this flash of black over by the trail leading into the woods. So I'm talking to my wife up on the porch and walking across, and I got about 4 or 5 foot away, and I'm start talking to the dog, and I turned and looked at her, and it was a fisher. And I don't know who was more surprised, but it kind of stretched its neck up and looked at me with big eyes and turned around and hopped off into the back up the trail. And I said, did you see that? My wife's like, see what? And I don't know. Like I said, I don't know who was more surprised.
No. But,
could that woman who had that weird animal on her trail cam, could it have been a pine marten? And that's all I'll say.
All right.
Yeah, certainly we've got pine martens in the state of Wisconsin. The pine marten population is not doing nearly as well as the fisher population is. And I think, it is possible when she described that big bushy black tail. I mean, that's a fisher for sure. You know, pine martens are kind of roughly the same shape, a little bit smaller than fishers. And typically pine martens have the coloration of their head is typically lighter than their body. And the other thing with pine martens, usually they have either a blonde or a kind of a fiery orange throat patch. And if you see that, it's almost impossible to mistake it for something else. But, you know, odder things have happened for sure.
There you go.
But that's a pretty neat story about the fisher. You know, one thing, we're always amazed at how adaptable animals are and how habituated they become to human beings. And even though we really don't think about fishers living in and around human beings, maybe that's one of those species that is somewhat plastic in their behavior. And you know, who knows, in the future, maybe they will be backyard neighbors of human beings.
We have a quiz. I almost forgot about our quiz. I've got to bring that up here to get people involved. We got a little quiz for you, and we have the winner of this quiz will get a copy of the Critters of Wisconsin book as a prize, which is a really cool little book. It's got wonderful color photos of many of the bird species, and well, not only birds, but the animals you're going to find right here in Wisconsin. Very cool little book David came up with. Well, Dave, it was yours anyway. You're giving this out of your own.
Well, you know, I'm a giver, Larry.
Well, I'll tell you what, you'll like this little Critters book. And here's what's going to happen is we're going to give you the question, but when you hear the question and if you have an answer, we want you to email it to talk@wpr.org. And so go to talk@wpr.org and put quiz in the subject line and also include where you live in the message. And if you don't want to do that, if you don't aren't online, you can also call 1-800-642-1234 and call in with your answer. But that's more chancy because you're going to get a lot of busy signals for that. But, okay, so talk@wpr.org, put quiz in the subject line, give the answer, include where you live in the message, or call us at 800-642-1234. Here is the question. Who was the guest wildlife expert on Wisconsin Public Radio before Scott Craven? Who was the wildlife expert on WPR before Scott Craven?
I think we're going back to the 1800s, aren't we, Larry?
Well, I worked with a guy. I actually worked with a man, and he was a great guy. So, and he had one of these radio voices, one of these really deep, booming voices. And I was also always a little jealous of that voice. I thought, oh, man, there's a perfect radio voice, and then here's Squeaky Larry. So, anyway, that's the question. And, again, it's talk@wpr.org. Put quiz in the subject line. And include where you live in the message. Also, you can call 1-800-642-1234. And now Judith is going to be very busy for the next 10 minutes or so. We'll run this, 10 minutes? Yeah, we'll do it for 10 minutes. And what we'll do is there'll be some correct answers, I would guess, more than one. And in that case, we'll have all the names, Judith will randomly select, put it in a hat. Or she closes her eyes and points or something. I don't know how she does it, but it's random. I can tell you that for sure. Let's go to Gary in Cedar Lake. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. I bought my home on Cedar Lake in 04. And at that time, I had a family of black mink living on my property. It's a fairly wooded property. And I really enjoyed watching them, and they were friendly, and to the point where one time I was sitting on like a lounge chair down at the lake, and one of them ran right underneath my chair. And then muskrats started showing up, and the black mink disappeared. So I'm wondering if there's a connection, if the muskrats pushed the mink out. And over the years, the muskrats continued to live on my property, and they would swim across the front of my property many times, and they're powerful swimmers and really strong animals, and they have big claws. And apparently, I wasn't the only one on this lake that had muskrats, because the Lake Association hired a trapper this past fall, and he trapped over 200 muskrats on our 150-acre lake. And I'm wondering, if we hadn't hired a trapper, does a muskrat have a predator? Is there a natural predator other than man that would have come in and controlled these muskrats or not?
Gary, all good questions. So let's start off with the mink. Mink are amazing little animals. They're in the Mustelid family, weasel family, so have kind of a tubular body, usually all black with a little bit of a white patch right under their chin. Really, really neat animals. Active year-round, they're a fur bearer species. Associated typically with wetter areas and around wetlands, things like that. As are muskrats. And muskrats are an aquatic rodent. So they've got, look like a rat. They've got a kind of a hairless tail, just like a rat does, and webbed feet in the back, and kind of a, you know, a almost like a sable brown coat the muskrat has, and a little bit of a kind of a oval or oblong shaped body to it. Most likely what I'm guessing happened, muskrats are vegetarians, so they eat plant material, and they can very quickly eat out a wetland, especially a cattail marsh. And I'm guessing what probably happened is that as the muskrats, if they cleared the vegetation out of there, the type of food that the mink are relying on, small mammals and some other aquatic animals and things like that, may have gone away because they've lost their cover. And without that cover, they've got no safety.
Yeah.
And so most likely what may have happened if this relationship is true that you're talking about is that if the muskrats ate out all the cover, the food supply for the mink may have moved someplace else. But and minks, muskrats, you know, can be very, very destructive animals. They can burrow into dike banks and drain wetlands because of that. And they, as I mentioned, they can eat out vegetation and things like that. So it's a lot of times people look at muskrats as pest species, and they do trap them out pretty commonly. They're relatively easy to trap, and they also provide a pretty good coat. So in the wintertime, you know, the mink, if you've ever seen, or excuse me, muskrat, if you've ever had anybody with a muskrat coat, it's a pretty soft coat.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, Judith tells me she's a font of knowledge, isn't she? I say, how does she do this randomly? And she says, there's a website. It's called random.org. And she can do her random drawing from that. Well, my goodness.
That's good. That's why we're on the radio, and she's doing all the important
she's
stuff.
She's doing all the work.
Yeah.
Debbie sent us a picture of a Cooper's hawk watching her bird feeders, yep, which is really a cool picture. And someone wondered, Patrick, I think, said, could that small black panther, the woman thought she saw, have been an otter. And
excuse me, but I don't recall the specific. I think she said something about the habitat or the type of area the black panther was in. But you know, typically, obviously, otters are going to be associated with wetland or rivers or some kind of a water body. So I don't know. You know, again. I mean, otter things have happened, but you'd have to be either drinking or have really bad eyesight to mistake a cougar for an otter.
Yeah, probably. Carolyn Arlington, your turn. Hi there.
Hi, guys. I have more or less just a story to share with you. Last Friday, I was walking by my window, and I noticed I have a horse pasture, and my horse pasture butts up against woods we own. And I saw my horse going crazy. He was jumping up and down, which isn't untypical, but he wasn't playing with his toy, which he has out there. His whatever it was moving, and I looked a little closer, and here was a pretty big fox, and he was chasing her. Well, it got to a point where he would stop, she'd turn around, and she'd chase him, and then she went into the woodline. Then she'd wait a little while, dart back out, chase him back to the other side. I'd never seen anything like that before.
So they were playing.
They were absolutely playing. Huh. And what it told me was this wasn't the first encounter this horse had with this fox. I'm assuming this has been going on for quite a while. And I've never seen anything like that. I didn't know they were capable of playing with such a large, different animal, I guess.
No, that's very cool.
That's a pretty neat story. Yep.
Yeah. I love that story,
yeah,
actually.
That's a pretty good story. You know, that's one of the things that animals, you know, have a lot of different stimulations that they come in contact with over the course of their day or their life, and you never know what they're going to do with that stimulant or how they're going to play with it. But animals are very, very creative, so that's a neat story.
I had a friend, Bob Cooney, who was hunting in the woods, and he was up on a hill kind of looking down in a wooded valley, and there were some deer and some turkeys. One of the deer would kind of sneak over and then rush at the turkeys and then run back. and it did that four or five times. They're just playing, you know, just hop back.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
So, yeah, they're definitely capable of that sort of thing. Joanne in Cuba City, hello to you.
Hi, Larry.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, I heard your guys' discussion earlier about the hawk, and I've had this hawk, and I'm not very familiar with hawks, and for some reason my computer, I went to look on your Facebook page, but I couldn't, my computer's messed up this morning, I don't know what the heck it's doing. But anyway, I'm wondering, I've had this hawk hanging out in my neighborhood the last couple weeks, and I've been leery of letting my cats out, and they're all, like, mad at me because they want to go outside.
Yeah.
But I'm worried if the hawk would be a danger to them, or if that's, I don't have any idea.
A hawk would have had a cat, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if I've shared this story with you before, Larry, but there was, in New York City, it's common for them to use hawks and falcons to kind of patrol the parks there for pigeons and rats. And there was a story, I don't know, a number of years ago, about a woman who was walking her hairless chihuahua in one of these parks. And one of the hawks that was being used to patrol the park actually came down and attacked the chihuahua and carried it off for a few feet before it dropped it. The chihuahua lived with a few puncture wounds. But, certainly a hawk, as would a number of other raptors, go after a cat. Absolutely they would.
Absolutely. So there you go. Watch it, Joanne. We have David Drake with us today. Aren't we having fun? He's a wildlife specialist, the UW Extension, and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Talking about the wonderful world of wildlife, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Please go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Lots of fun pictures. You can post your own photo, or you can also ask a question right there. Lots of callers online, so I think we should go right back to the phones and hook up with Pat in New London. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, a few of the people in the beginning of the program were talking about great horned owls.
Yeah.
And I have a great horned owl on 3 eggs in my backyard, and we have a camera on her, and she's on the internet.
Wow.
Oh, cool.
That's
neat. And I'm wondering if maybe you would just like to pass that along, and people can watch Ms. Harvey.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to have to go through my webpage, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's thefeather.org.
Thefeather.org?
Yep, and then you just scroll down to the picture of a great horned owl. And we have an eagle cam, too, but the eagles aren't on the nest yet.
Huh, that's neat.
You can scroll down to those pictures and then click on that link, and it'll take you to the camera.
Thefeather.org. Judith's right on that. We might even post that up on our...
That's
on my page so that people can link right straight to it from my page.
Well, that would be cool.
Say, Pat, pay attention to those eagle nests, though. The DNR just did an aerial survey of eagles in the lower Wisconsin River Valley, and they saw some eagles that were starting to tend to nests already. So that eagle could may be back sooner than you know.
She's in the area. She just hasn't been on the nest that we're aware of yet.
Huh, oh, that is very cool.
And we're also going to put up an osprey nest in Manawa, but we don't have that camera up yet.
Aren't you the busy little bee?
That is great.
We're going to give everybody a chance to watch wildlife.
Oh, that's wonderful. Have you been on the bear one? Bear.org?
Yes, I have. Yes, and I've been watching all the eagles down in Decorah, but Wisconsin needs its own eagle cam.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be pretty fun.
All right.
Thanks, Pat. And again, so it's thefeather.org. You're a peach. Thanks.
That's impressive.
Appreciate it very much. All right. Well, a lot of people are going to be going to that site, I would bet. Scott in Cedarburg, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, I've been listening to talk about fishers.
Yeah.
I hunt up around Spooner, Wisconsin, and every deer season I've been seeing fishers up there. They seem to hump along a little bit like a mink would, only they're, of course, bigger and black.
Yes.
I thought fishers' primary food was porcupines, and I haven't seen any porcupines at all.
Yeah, they'll eat any, much anything, I think.
Well, you know, fishers, if you ever get a good look at a fisher or just even look at a picture of them, they've got pretty well-defined claws, and they're a pretty powerful animal. So a lot of times what they'll do, and they usually use, like as I mentioned a while ago, old growth forests with a lot of dead down timber on the forest floor. And they use those big claws to kind of tear apart that disintegrating, rotting wood that's on the forest floor as they chase after chipmunks and small mammals like mice and things like that. So you know, those small mammals are really the base, the food base for fishers. But the fishers certainly are known for one of the few species of animal that can kill a porcupine and get away with it without getting quills in it. And the way the fisher typically does it is attack the porcupine in its face region where there's either no or very few quills around the face, and that obviously around the nose and the eyes is very sensitive. And once they've kind of disabled the porcupine, they roll it over, and then they start eating it from the belly inward. And that belly, again, has very few quills on it, if any at all. And that's the way the fisher is able to kill a porcupine, that they're quicker and meaner than the porcupine.
Yeah.
I thought they'd actually run out on the limb that the porcupine might be on and open them up from the belly, from the underside of the limb.
Well, that's if you're out on a limb of a tree, that's a pretty precarious place to be facing a porcupine full of quills. So typically they're on the ground, and it's kind of even footing, probably a little bit of an advantage for the fisher on the ground versus being on a limb.
Yep, there you go.
But
they'll eat a lot of small rodents then.
Yep. But porcupines certainly are very good climbers, and a lot of times they will scurry for the trees for safety.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Guido in Okauchee Lake, hello to you.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great, thank you for calling. And what's on your mind?
Well, I live on Okauchee, as I said, and we've had over the last 2 years some really unique incidents with some, I'm guessing, invasive species that I've done some research on. On Okauchee, on the east side, there's a little lake connected through a channel called Garvin Lake. And last fall, we encountered some freshwater jellyfish in bloom on the entire lake. We thought they were like pollen on the water, but after further inspection and some little snorkeling, the entire lake, probably about 30 acres, was completely infested with freshwater jellyfish. And I've taken pictures and posted videos and contacted the DNR, but haven't heard anything back in a little over a year, which I thought would get somebody's attention. And the other thing was that I have pictures of this as well. My poor little daughter, 9 years old at the time, was attacked by a rather large fish and bit on her foot, which actually impeded her from swimming. And
wow,
I could imagine.
And we thought initially it was a northern or a muskie until we saw the bite mark. And I'd love for your guest to take a peek at these pictures. I personally think it's a snakehead or some sort of invasive fish based on the bite pattern. But it ripped her foot up almost to the point of having to take her to the emergency room. And she's about, 4 feet tall and about maybe 40, 50 pounds. And it actually stopped her from swimming.
Wow.
And the bite pattern's pretty remarkable to look at. Has anyone experienced anything like the jellyfish or these aggressive fish?
Jellyfish, yes.
Yeah, freshwater jellyfish are new to me, though. I've spent quite a bit of my life out on the East Coast and have swum in salt water, and jellyfish stings were never pleasant out there.
Yeah.
So I can imagine how bad it is for freshwater as well. I'm not familiar with any snakehead fish in Wisconsin. I'm not familiar with the reported snakehead fish in Wisconsin, thankfully. But, certainly people, there are legendary stories about people losing toes from musky bites and northerns and things like that. So who knows what kind of fish it is. You're welcome to send the pictures to me if you would like to. I'd be glad to take a look at them and see if I can either figure it out myself or pass it on to a fisheries biologist.
Could you share your email again, please?
Sure. It's ddrake2, so D as in David, Drake, D-R-A-K-E, the number 2.
Okay.
At WISC, the first four letters of Wisconsin. So WISC.edu.
Oh, okay. D-Drake 2 at WISC.edu. Perfect.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, sorry to hear about your daughter.
Yeah, that's too bad. And probably it's, she's probably not real excited to swim anymore in that water.
It's a great story.
Yeah. Freshwater version of Jaws.
All right, and Judith is telling me that the quiz is over, and
all right.
For all of the entries, there were only 2 correct answers.
Wow.
And I don't know who the other person was, but the other person, here you had a half 50-50 chance and you didn't win. Instead, Sharon G. in Black Earth won, and the correct answer is Bob Ellerson. The Wonderful World of Nature. He did a program. It was a 15-minute program, and he was ranger something or other too at one point. And he was also a guest on this program early. I was a young guy then.
Yeah.
That was a while back. But he was a guest on this program, actually several times.
Yeah.
And really great guy. And Scott actually kind of replaced Bob when Bob retired.
Yep, that's right. So Bob Ellison, if he was not the first extension wildlife specialist in the country, he was certainly probably one of the first five in the country.
Oh, yeah.
And I've just heard, unfortunately, I did not have the pleasure of meeting him. I have met his son a number of times, and his son is just a gracious, gentleman. Mm-hmm. But I've heard just the most wonderful stories about Bob, and I'm actually very sorry I was never able to meet him.
Yeah, he was a really great guy. He's passed on now.
Yeah, that's right.
He's been for
right.
a few years now.
But this is a long-standing topic on Wisconsin Public Radio wildlife.
Oh, and frankly, one of our most popular topics, for sure.
That's pretty neat. Well done, Sharon.
Yes, you will be receiving a copy of Critters of Wisconsin.
And I'll tell you what, Larry, since we only had two winners, why don't we send the other person also who got the correct answer another copy of Critters of Wisconsin. I'll dig one up and we'll send both people who got the answer correct in honor of Bob Ellison.
Ah, that's wonderful. Thank you, David. David Drake, our guest, he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Many of us live in Wisconsin who do live in Wisconsin count our amazing wildlife as one of our real treasures. And today we're lucky enough to have David Drake as our guide, our wildlife guide. He's an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, an extension wildlife specialist. And with us until 12:30 today to answer your questions. Have you spotted an animal or a bird recently for the first time? Wonder about it? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. But I really hope you'll also go to my Facebook page. Go to The Larry Mueller Show. You can post questions or photos there. We've had some great ones today. And click like while you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on our programs. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking the world of wildlife today with David Drake. David is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, a professor in forest and wildlife ecology at UW. Great to have him along. He's one of our regulars here on the Ideas Net. So it's great to have him here, and thank you so much for listening in. We have lots of callers online. The number, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234. Dave in Oregon has a question or comment for you, so let's go there. Hi, Dave. Dave, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost Dave. Must have lost Dave. Well, let's go to Terry in Green Bay then. Let's see if we can get there. Terry, hi.
Good afternoon. Hi. Just questioning what your guest feels about all the stormwater retention ponds that are being added to our urban areas and that effect on wildlife. And then the second question would be wood duck housing with the mild temperatures. What would be the earliest wood duck
and
it would nest and lay eggs?
All right, Terry. So we'll start with the retention pond question first, I guess. Any time the habitat is changed, either for good or for bad, you've got winners and you've got losers. And so, sometimes those retention ponds can be good for a waterfowl, for example. It's good, just wetland habitat. Mink and muskrats and a whole host of other animals might come in there. It can be bad in the sense that it also attracts a lot of waterfowl. So if you've got a Canada goose problem already in your community and you keep adding wetlands, your Canada goose problem is only going to get worse. So, and from a zoning issue, the retention ponds are there to kind of control water flow, especially during storms and runoff and things like that. So, it can be good and it can be bad. Wood ducks obviously are wonderful. Some people think they're one of the most beautiful species of waterfowl we have, and absolutely, especially the male, are absolutely a gorgeous duck. Cavity nesters, so they're associated with forested wetland type areas. Very common to use wood duck boxes and things like that. But typically they're not going to be nesting for a little bit longer, probably another month or two, something like that.
All right, there we go.
Yeah, we normally try to clean out our wood duck houses around Valentine's Day.
Yep.
But when we've done it in the middle or late March, sometimes we'll find eggs, and they don't seem to be leftover eggs from the previous year. So I was kind of curious as to how early they would. But you're thinking it's a good month or two away.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, everything might be accelerated a bit now because we're having such a mild winter. But again, you know, a lot of those breeding cycles are controlled by day length. And I mean, that's the primary cues. As the day length gets longer, things then start, their bodies start changing hormonally and start keying in on the idea that it's now starting to time to breed. And so they're pretty tied to that. You might, change that by a week or two or something like that, but change it by a month would be a little unusual.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your comments and your insight.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Jack in Keewaskum, thank you for calling. Hello.
You're welcome. Hello. My main question is about the cycle of flying squirrels, but just a couple comments on this warm weather. Last week I saw chipmunks, and I'd never seen them in February.
Yeah.
And there's bluebirds around here.
Yep.
And I never saw them in the winter. Anyhow, on flying squirrels, we have a lot of them around. I live in the Kettle Moraine Forest, and we have a lot of them around. And when they're around, you'll see them every day, every night, on the feeders for maybe 4, 5, 6 months. And all of a sudden, they disappear. They might disappear for a year. And I'm wondering if they're so tame to humans, if they're so tame when like the barred owls are around, if it's predators are killing them off, or if they just find other food sources.
Yeah, that's a good question, Jack. Let me quickly address your chipmunk question. So chipmunks are we call them kind of restive hibernators. They're a light sleeping hibernator, but it's not uncommon for chipmunks. Even when we have traditional winters, they'll wake up every couple 2 or 3 weeks or so in their burrow, and they'll go and feed, and then they'll go back to sleep for a couple more weeks. But it's not uncommon on warm winter days with the sun shining for them to pop their head up above ground and then go back down below ground and ride out the rest of the winter. So it's even though you haven't seen them, it's not a terribly uncommon event. In terms of flying squirrels, we've got two species in the state of Wisconsin, southern and northern, and typically the southern is smaller than the northern. But there seems to be some evidence suggesting that the southern flying squirrel is pushing further and further north in the state and is actually pushing the northern squirrel out of at least its southern range here in the state of Wisconsin. Mm. And obviously squirrels are a rodent species, so that, their population can fluctuate up and down based on, certainly predation, certainly on food availability, mating availability and things like that. So it's not uncommon that animal populations cycle up and down a little bit. It may not be as regular as, for example, the 10-year cycle of ruffed grouse. But, some years you've got more of a particular species than you do other years.
Hmm. Thanks again for calling. By the way, a related story here from Dave. Routinely see a couple of flying squirrels around dusk just east of Hayward. They run up and down a small oak tree. Last Sunday night, we saw quite a few more. I walked out to the tree to spread some breadcrumbs around the bird feeders, and instead of hiding, they all came right up to me. At one point, I counted close to 10 flying from tree to tree and landing right next to me on a bird feeder. They reminded me of chipmunks in that they seemed to respond to my voice by coming even closer. And they're breeding habits, yep. Breeding season is...
Let's see. For flying squirrels, they probably are starting to breed pretty soon here if they're not already doing so. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, they're pretty neat. The flying squirrels are really just kind of a neat animal. Yeah. And obviously, they're not a true flying mammal like a bat would be. But they certainly, from a elevated perch, can glide a pretty considerable distance horizontally at least.
Mark in Marshfield, your turn now. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is, last summer I saw some otters on my pond, and I noticed after the otters left, I didn't see my painted turtles. Will an otter take them out, or is there a predator for turtles?
For some of the smaller turtles, certainly the young turtles are small, and there's more predation on the young turtles. Once you get to be an adult-sized turtle, and you've got that hard shell and carapace, you've got pretty good protection, but otters are pretty strong animals, and they've got very well-developed teeth, and it's probably not uncommon for an otter to eat a turtle if they can get them.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thanks for calling, Mark. An email from David regarding that white hawk that we talked about earlier.
Yep.
Did you consider a northern harrier? We have one in northern Greene County seen as recently as 5 days ago. The photo that we have up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show does not allow for a wingtip view.
You know, the one reason I didn't bring up northern harriers because typically the harriers are associated more with a grassland or a open habitat, and this hawk is sitting in a tree, and it looks like there's quite a few trees around it, at least from the glimpse of the picture there. You know, obviously harriers will sit up in trees, but they're associated much more with an open habitat than they are a forested habitat.
Mike in Rice Lake, we turn to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I just had a couple of quick comments that might be pertinent to some of your previous callers.
Sure.
One of them, as far as the diets for the fishers, I live in a on the shore of a small bog pond up here in southern Washburn County, and about four or five years ago, some friends of ours were having a little barbecue out here on the patio, and I heard this young fawn bleating. It was late spring, early summer, and calling, and it would call every 10, 15 minutes and then stop. And so in the evening, I took a walk around and walked out on the bog, and I kind of honed in on the sound, and I could see this little newborn fawn's head pop up in the air, and then this little black furry thing would grab it by the throat and drag the head down, and it would stop bleeding or calling. And it would do that, and I kind of inched closer, and it was a young fisher. And I didn't realize that fishes would take fawns. I figured they'd scavenge them possibly. But this fisher apparently couldn't grasp the throat strong enough to kill the fawn. And that went on all evening. And my wife was sensitive to that. And so we had to close our windows in order to fall asleep.
You didn't try to chase the fisher away.
No, well, it was. I didn't want to interfere with nature, obviously.
Yeah.
And I looked around for the doe, and I couldn't see the doe around anywhere. And I went out the next morning, and the fawn was gone. There was no signs of death there, but I could see a drag pattern going off through the bog onto the shore, and I figured possibly a bear honed in on it and took care of matters overnight. But that was kind of interesting. But the one thing, your caller earlier about raptors taking pets, I'm a veterinarian, and one of my clients is a county sheriff, and he had brought his dog in once, and he said, he was telling me a story about he got called out for a white tine that had an active eagle's nest, and it was blown over on the shore of one of the lakes around here towards a house. And so they called the DNR out, and they had to get permission to cut the tree down with the eagle's nest in it. And they did give them permission, and they got the tree down and the nest out, and they disassembled the nest. And he told me they counted 14 pet collars buried in the nest throughout the wood.
Oh.
And you know, this is a well-populated recreational lake in the area. And I have worked with clients that have pets that have been attacked by a variety of raptors, not just eagles and owls, but the smaller hawks, too. So that was kind of enlightening.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just 14 of them.
It's not something.
Yeah, 14. I'm sure there are cat and dog collars mixed in there, but just as a warning to people who live around, the raptors will get after the smaller pets. So,
maybe
my comments.
I guess the moral of the story is hang a 5-pound dumbbell off your pet if you're going to release it so it can't get taken up in the air.
Yeah.
Everything's got to eat, and the same thing with that fisher. You know, fishers are very efficient carnivores, and they won't pass up on a meal, even if it's out of the ordinary for them.
Yeah,
thanks. I've seen adult fishers, and this one was a younger juvenile, and he just didn't seem to have the wherewithal, the knowledge, or the strength to dispatch the fawn, and so it was surprising because I know how aggressive they can be when they're adults.
Oh, man. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome very much.
Yeah, great stories. Thank you very much for calling. Boy, Kathleen in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I have a possible solution to what may be in the jellyfish.
Okay.
Because I was at Mirror Lake. We were camping, and we were using the canoe, and as we went around the lake, there were gelatinous balls in the water. So I asked the people in the nature the nature people out there, and I said, what could this be? And they had no idea. So it bothered me 1 year, and I researched it, and I forgot about it, and then something triggered my memory, and the next year I researched it, and what I came up with was, it was when I Googled in bryozoans, because I know what the name now is. It's a bryozoan, B-R-Y-O-Z-O-A-N-S. And I put down Minnesota DNR because the article I found talks about gelatinous balls commonly studied in the summer, and what they are supposedly are, and possibly may be the same thing, colonies of bryozoans, which are an aquatic invertebrate.
Huh.
And they are, they kind of float around. They look like, almost like the summer size of volleyballs, but they kind of all hover together, and they float off of, like, piers or weeds, and they have jelly-like tubes, and these are microscopic animals. And it's, maybe this is what they saw, because I didn't know what. Because I said, I've seen it the size of volleyballs, and they're, like, just below the surface, and they're floating there. And we'd be looking at them thinking, like, are these jellyfish? And we weren't sure. So I'm thinking that maybe if you could, if someone take a look at
them. Yeah, bryozoans.
Interesting.
It's bryozoans, and I sent it to the Mirror Lake the next year when I found it. I said, is it possibly this is what I may have seen when we were out there? And so I've never heard of anything backed by it, but they are common in the rivers in the Minnesota, rivers, ponds, and streams or in Minnesota. So I thought, well, it's not that far away.
No, for sure.
Kathleen, in your reading, did it say whether or not those were native to Wisconsin or Minnesota?
As I recall, because I pulled it up on my computer now, and as I recall that they don't really do anything, they're just there. They are not toxic, venomous, or harmful. They don't really seem to cause problems for people except for the ick factor and occasionally clogging underwater screens or pipes.
Oh,
interesting.
Just another really strange life form that are in our waters that most people don't even know exist. And I had never seen them before that, and I don't even remember seeing them. Like we go back to Mirror Lake and canoe, and I haven't seen it then. But it was just happened to be something that we saw, like slightly below the water, submerged, looking like different kinds of balls.
Interesting. You learn something new every day.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate the call. That was very interesting. By the way, we put up a link to Judith did it. to livewildlifecams.com, and there is a Wisconsin Eagle cam. Caller, let us know. It's on Facebook, and it's eaglesforkids.com, which I should have remembered because that's come up before. Eagles, and then the number four, eaglesforkids.com, and that's a Wisconsin cam. Jim in Greenwood, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. I've got a story that actually started 6 years ago when my late father-in-law, when we were living with them, and he was an avid bird feeder, and he had one right outside the back porch, and one day a hawk came down and swooped down and took down a mourning dove and sat there in the yard for a better part of an hour consuming it and without too much trouble. And anyway, a couple days later, we came home with some groceries in the side yard, and we were loading groceries out of the car, and there was a hovering sound, a kind of swooping over our heads, and this hawk came over and swooped down and touched. My wife was wearing a black fuzzy hat, and it actually touched the top of her head. And then flew up and must have decided it wasn't an animal and flew up back on the eave of the porch. And it was, you know, it was one of those things that moments that just are unforgettable. And we were trying to figure out, was it a Cooper's hawk or was it a sharp shin? But anyway, we wondered about that over the years. But in the meantime, after my father-in-law passed, I moved the took down the bird feeder, and I dug the dirt around and put it down in the garden where we were going to have some wildflower garden, and just I thought it was just good fertilizer. Well, we have had for the last 5 years, we've had a wonderful growth of sunflowers that come up every year that the birds can feed off of, and it's really a neat thing. But the last time Scott Craven was on, with the description between the sharp shin and the Cooper's hawk, we've determined that it was a Cooper's hawk because it was a little bit bigger.
Yep.
So it's just a continuation. But that having that hawk flutter down and touch the top of her head with that hat on. His
grabbed her hat.
That's pretty funny.
Unforgettable memory for us.
Oh, thanks, Jim. Another great story.
You know what? You get 10 birders together, and they might see the same bird, and you'd have 10 arguments about what different bird that is. So, and Cooper's hawk and sharp-shinned hawks are you know, one of those species that are easily confused, especially as they're flying through the air. But you know, typically Cooper's hawks are bigger, obviously, as you mentioned, than sharp shins, and they've got a rounded tail at the end, edge of their tail, and they usually have a thicker, what's called a terminal band, a terminal white band at the end of their tail as well. It's it is certainly possible it mistook your wife's hat for something, a food source, but so, you know, a lot of times if you have ever been around barn swallows, for example, they're nesting up under the eave of a house and they've got a nest there, they'll dive bomb you because they want you out of the area. And it is possible maybe that there was something there the hawk was trying to protect her, or it was territorial, and perhaps your wife got a little bit too close. But
thanks again for calling,
that's
Jim.
A good
appreciate
story.
It. Yeah, great story. Roxanne in Trade Lake. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, 2 weeks ago, I and a friend were hiking on the Straight Lake, along the Straight River, on the Ice Age Trail into Straight Lake State Park, just east of Frederick. And we heard some noises and wondered if it was possibly turkeys. And all of a sudden, whatever it was flew, and it was four trumpeter swans.
Oh.
On the way back out to the road, there was two of them back down along the open water, and they were kind of just hiking around and making all sorts of pasturing and whatever, and we just thought, gee, it's kind of early if they're, you know, starting to do a little bit of mating rituals. Well, 2 days ago, I was out west of Frederick, and there was probably 15 or so trumpeters in a field, and doing the same thing. Isn't it a little bit early for something like that? And I mean, we do have open water around here, but I mean, that's a lot.
Yep, it is a little bit early, but you know that saying, the earlier bird gets the worm. If you can maybe get out here and establish breeding territory and start finding a mate, even though you may not be laying eggs right now, if you can get a jump on your competitors, you may have a leg up, so to speak. So it is a bit early, but, you know, again, there's a lot of odd stuff going on right now because we don't have a typical winter either.
Yeah. But
that's a neat sighting.
Yeah, it was really neat, the pasturing and whatever.
Yeah, they are magnificent birds.
Yep. Yeah, it was pretty great.
Thanks, Rex.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. And we've got Laura in Eau Claire County who concurs with a woman who said she saw a panther on the Highway 27 area. We live not far from there, a few miles, and I saw a panther in my backyard in spring of 08 tussling with a fawn. Fisher's in the weasel family, obviously not a cat creature. Yep. This panther we saw was in the cat family, cat features.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's a pretty nice memory to have.
And let's see, email from Will spotted four turkey vultures circling over Rib Mountain State Park near Wausau. That's the 45th parallel, a little early, do you think?
Yes, but, you know, turkey vultures will kind of be an eruptive species as well and can come up into the area. Obviously, you know, again, because we've had such a mild winter, there's some early sightings of species we normally don't see at this time of the year.
And Anna in Appleton the other night heard a bunch of, would be a mob of crows start crowing at midnight or 12:30. Yep. What would make them do that? Probably an owl.
Possibly, yep. And, you know, Anna, the funny name for a group of crows, they call it a murder of crows.
Murder. So I said mob. It's a murder of crows.
And crows are very common for mobbing as a group of crows. They'll mob owls and hawks and things like that as a defense mechanism. Because those raptors will certainly eat both the adult crows, but they also will raid crow nests. And so it is probably at that time of the night, it's probably that they were after an owl.
Yep, there we go. And boy, here we are out of time. And I'm just looking, Dave in Oregon said there were 391 robins counted in Madison this winter. So they're around.
Yep.
And you're around, and you're going to still be around, I assume. You come back in a month or so and talk with us again.
Anytime you want to invite me back, I'll gladly reappear, Larry.
Oh, thanks so much. David Drake is a wildlife specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension and Associate Professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He'll be back, and we will do this all over again. And tomorrow, CPA Dale Coonan is going to be here to answer your tax preparation questions. Have you figured your taxes yet? Haven't figured mine yet, unfortunately. I never look forward to that. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.